My guest today on the Science Studio is Sir Harold Kroto. He's currently at Florida State University, but in 1996 he shared the Nobel Prize in Chemistry for the discovery of a new form of carbon, the C60 molecule called Buckminster Fullerene. He's received the Royal Society's prestigious Michael Faraday Award, given annually to the scientist who's done the most to further public communication of science, engineering, or technology in the United Kingdom, although he now lives here. He's chairman of the board of the Vega Science Trust, which is an educational charity that produces science programs for television. Harry, welcome.
My pleasure.
So give me some sense of where you came from, what's your family background, how you got into science.
Well, my parents were refugees from Berlin, and my father got out of Germany the day before the police came to arrest him. My mother wasn't Jewish, but he was. We ended up in a town called Bolton, which is the center of the Industrial Revolution as much as anywhere else. Samuel Crompton, spinning jenny, and it was the center of the spinning industry. So, and weaving as well, and I saw that decay as I was a child. I had a great childhood in the sense that I was very happy and went to a good school. My name originally was Krotoschina, and that's rather...
Where does that come from?
Well, it's a German form of... and there's a Polish form, Krotoszynski, and it comes from Krotoszyn, a town which is now in Poland, but then was then in East Prussia, and so that problem area, no longer a problem, but was then. And then when you're in a town where everybody's called, I suppose, Higginbottom, Thistlethwaite, Entwistle, Ramsbottom, Smith and Jones, Krotoschina is a bit difficult, so my father cut it in half. So now everybody thinks I'm Japanese or something like this. So, until they see me, and then they realize not quite. But so it's a it's interesting that I was brought up in a totally Anglo-Saxon environment, in the sense that all the kids had very English names. And today I look at the kids coming to university in the UK. There are hardly any. You know, it's just amazing change in 40 years or 50 years. It's just amazing.
So Bolton, that time, yeah. Lancashire, the
fantastic
northwest
town
of England.
Yeah, Bolton Wanderers.
Bolton Wanderers football team. But this would be just after, during the war,
I was born in Cambridgeshire, actually, in Wisbeach. My mother was evacuated when the war started. I was born in the first month of the war,
right,
in October 1939. And then she was evacuated. My father went to the Isle of Man, was interned there for some period, but my mother was shipped out to, she had a choice of two places, Peterborough and Bolton. And why she chose Bolton, I don't know, but it turned out to be a good choice. And I suppose why I'm a scientist, to get to that, is that basically my main passion is art and graphics. But my father, being a refugee, insisted that I'd be good at maths, science first. Because he recognized that, as many refugees do, that their kids need to have the good statistical chance of earning a living. So that's what it was. But I never set out to be a scientist. I was just good at chemistry and physics and maths and art and geography and all these things. And I had a very good childhood as a kid because I really liked going to school. But then we lived in the slums, so school was up from where I was living at that
time. So you're growing up in a fairly small English city.
Yes.
On the verge of town and city. Small streets, terraces and so on.
That's right. And the police, we used local to know the
church,
policemen.
Local pubs.
No, I don't know. I never knew any of my friends who went to church. I mean, I didn't go to a pub when I was a kid, but I think that one of the big differences, you know, there were horses and carts. Horses drew the milk cart.
Mm-hmm.
And rag and bone men. So I was in that age. But I think what I remember most of you know, kids did things, you know, the policeman used to clip them over the ear roll and said, I'll tell your dad if you don't behave. And so there was a much better infrastructure, I felt, when I was a kid, of the way kids were taught to behave, you know. And there was, you know, the bobby used to walk up and down, so you knew these people. And so I think life has changed for the worse in that sense. But then I went to a very good school called Bolton School. which is the best school in the area, and I managed to scrape in there, and that was important.
Any particular teachers that set you off?
Definitely the chemistry teachers. Two of them really encouraged me, but also my art teacher. He used to give me extra lessons out of school, but I stopped having art lessons at 15 because, you know, you don't do art. I mean, that's not a career. It wasn't then. Today would be quite different, and I'm almost sure I would never have been a scientist 20 or 30 years later. I've been in architecture or graphic art, and certainly today in computer graphics. I mean, I would just take to that. So that limited upbringing got me a good scientific education, and I wanted to go to university, so I was good at chemistry, so I went to what at the time was one of the best, if not the best, chemistry department in England, which is in Sheffield. Then I wanted to stay at university because we were having a great time. I got married, Margaret was there, and we wanted to stay in Sheffield. So, you know, beats working, right? Although you're working very hard. And I was playing tennis because I played tennis for Sheffield, and I was designing the covers of the art magazines. I had a wonderful university time, and then I did a PhD because I wanted to stay there in chemistry.
Did you have any sense that, I mean, of what area of chemistry?
No. I remember very distinctly at school that I liked organic chemistry, and I think it's because I like drawing hot hexagons. Believe it or not, there was something about that, and then a lecturer came in, Richard Dixon, and started on spectroscopy. And at that moment, I was captured by spectroscopy and quantum mechanics as well. The two came together, and I was just fascinated. So I went almost overnight from being interested in organic chemistry to an interest in the fact that molecules could count, and that there was some fairly strong mathematical theories, although I wasn't great at it, I was good enough at it, and I could understand it, and there was a tremendously interesting clarity of what the information and the experiments that you were doing actually told you about molecules, their structures and bond lengths, and I feel that was very unusual and still is unusual in the sciences, that I was in a field that I was very lucky to be in, that when you made a measurement, of very small things, and you didn't know very much, but what you knew, you really knew. And I think that's somewhat interesting and rather special to spectroscopy. But then spectroscopy is the experiments that led to quantum mechanics and all these other things. And that was, I did a PhD in that. And so I still was just doing a PhD to stay in university and do something I really liked, and so I could play more tennis and have a good time at university, and particularly get involved with the art magazine Arrows. I was art director for that.
So I don't make a trivial and silly leap here, but I mean, I'm thinking about creativity and so on here. When you read about Kekulé dreaming, imagining snakes intertwined, ends up with a benzene ring. You just talked about drawing hexagons. You end up with a structure like C60. You're artistically inclined. I mean, do you ever think about the connections?
No, I think it's just an accident. I mean, they do make that connection. By the way, Kekulé, there's a lot of questioning about Kekulé's dream, this sort of iconic image that he was sitting in, because I think it's been questioned, and I think the questioning is certainly interesting. But to go back to that, people have said, isn't it interesting? You do all this art and graphics, and I do a lot of logos and graphic design and covers of this and covers of that and design websites. But I think it's an accident. I mean, it is a lucky accident that this molecule that Aldous Williams called the most beautiful molecule and has become an iconic image of chemistry is more luck than actual design, I think. But, you know, I really feel that people should know that I'm a good scientist. I'm not a fantastic scientist. I don't claim to be a smart... I know some fantastic scientists, but... and I was very happy with my science when, in 1984, and done some what I call... my best work was in phosphorus chemistry and spectroscopy, and then we made some very nice discoveries in radio astronomy of molecules in space. And then I was sort of thought, well, I'm going to set up my graphic studio now, and my science is going very well. I'm going to have this studio and call it the Vega Graphic Studio. And And then in 1985, I'm walking down the street with Rick Smalley and Bob Curl and Sean O'Brien, Jim Heath, the students, and someone kicks a ball over the fence, right? And it's a football. And it's more like that, that is a serendipitous discovery, which a lot of people like very much. Kids love it, you know, there's a buckyball and stuff like that. And
that really happened, though, right?
Yeah, that's the way. I mean, you know, I suggested a very boring little experiment. Not totally boring to me, but not very important to me, to Bob Curl and Rick Smalley at Rice University. And about a year and a half later, after thinking of how to do it and this sort of that, and the various aspects of that, and we did the experiment, and in, you know, after 3 or 4 days, we had a remarkable result, and in 8 days, nine days, we wrote a paper, and it was published, you know, it was published a month or so later in Nature, and that's what we got the prize for. And if, you know, I'm fine, you know, but I don't feel that this is great thing of me. It's not the most important thing I've done.
So, but explain, if you would, what is unusual. Explain what C60 means. Why is it different from the other forms?
Well, I just start off a little bit, because carbon is obviously the most important element. If there is importance, it's certainly one of the most important. Hydrogen, of course, and oxygen and others. But carbon is, the chemistry of carbon is vital to everything. So the chemistry of carbon and hydrogen and oxygen is organic chemistry. It underpins all our lives in biology, biochemistry. But carbon by itself, there is basically no chemistry, because it's graphite and diamond. They don't do anything. They don't do anything useful. It's a very peculiar aspect of this. And so, since time immemorial, these things like diamond and graphite have been known to our ancestors. Then we did an experiment, and others had done the experiment too. The others had seen this result, and there's another take-home lesson there. But we did an experiment, and something very peculiar happened. We discovered that if you put 60 carbon atoms together, it seemed to have an unusual stability. Now, 60 is a magic number. 12, 5, 10, you know, 2, 3, 6, they all go into it in a way that, nothing less than 60 does. So now you start to think about patterns, and then we came to the conclusion that it was the same structure as a soccer ball, that here was a molecule made of pure carbon. And if you'd said that to anybody prior to this, and Peter will probably agree with that, he said, you just would be laughed out of court. I mean, no chemist would ever think you could take pure carbon and dissolve it in benzene. It would act like a molecule. And yet that's what we discovered, and some 5 years later it was proven to be correct. And it opened up a whole new area of chemistry. And it also opened up, in a sense, it was the key to opening up what some people think is nanotechnology today. It didn't really, but it has become a sort of iconic image and a sort of gateway to nanoscience and nanotechnology, which I would say is a new perspective and a useful perspective of material science in the 21st century. And so it's got all these other things with it, but more than anything else, it told us something we didn't know or didn't appreciate. And that is, when you have a sheet of atoms, the edges are unstable. If the sheet is very big, it doesn't matter. But if it's small, those edges are, if they can close up, they will do. And we've discovered, and I think the main aspect of C6 is not that you can make it, but that it self-assembles by itself. And it tells us that on a microscopic scale, or what we call a nanoscale, at the scale of tens of atoms, there are microstructural drives which have to stability. So although the most stable form of carbon is graphite on a bulk scale, the most stable form of 60 carbon atoms is this soccer ball structure. Hmm. And I think to some extent this closure has meant that on a microscopic scale we're seeing what are called nanotubes, you know, very, very fine tubes, which are extremely exciting, because if we can bundle them together, you can make very strong materials. And the example I would say as that is, if I take a box of straws and spray very weak glue on each of these straws and put them all together nicely as they were in the box. If you beautiful, I mean, I always loved you looking at the top. I don't know why. I opened the box and I saw all those straws, all beautifully packed. And now we realize if we could glue them all together, as we can do with straws, you get a very strong material. We could do that with nanotubes, then we've got something fantastic. But they already have the glue. It's called Van der Waals attraction. They do stick together. The problem is we can't produce enough of them to bundle them together. And by enough, I mean 10 to the 15, like, you know, 1,000, million bundled together just to make something 1 centimeter diameter. And that would be incredibly strong. You could make a tennis racket, and I could beat Roger Federer if I had the first one before he got it. That was my dream, to be Wimbledon champion, but that never came off. I kept losing.
So did it feel, I mean, this is a People magazine level question, but did it feel like you'd made a discovery? I mean, was there a moment of...
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt. Basically, the experiment started on a Monday, and almost immediately we saw, because you could look at, what we did was we vaporized graphite. I mean, Rick Smalley had made a fantastic breakthrough. He'd done something that had people had wanted to do for tens of years. He'd taken a laser and vaporized a metal and managed to get what are called clusters, more than two atoms of a metal. Before that, you heated a metal. If you're lucky, one atom came off, or two together, dimers. What Rick had done is he'd laser vaporized it into an argon gas, and as these atoms came up, they hit the gas and were cooled and constricted into a bundle and then jiggled around to form a stable cluster. And when I saw that, I thought, well, if we put graphite in there, we could sort of simulate the conditions in a star. Okay. And we'd done some radio astronomy. One of my favorite bits of work is that we discovered that in space between the stars there are these long carbon chain molecules. So I thought, well, let's use Rick's apparatus. Rick Smalley, who unfortunately died a couple of years ago, he had battled cancer for 8 years, but he'd made this fantastic breakthrough, and I thought we'll do this. And when we did that, there weren't these molecules that we'd seen in space, but this damn C60 was sitting up there. And so we started to pay attention. When it's so big, said, I'm the most important guy on the block. And no one had ever seen anything like this before. And then that was on the Wednesday. We decided to focus on it over the weekend. Jim Heath and Sean O'Brien worked over it, particularly Jim. And on the Monday, we sat down and said, we've got something special here. We've got to find some explanation of 60 carbon atoms. And you're forced to patterns, some sort of symmetric structure. You've got nothing else. By Tuesday, we recognized that it could be this soccer ball structure, where you take a soccer ball which has 12 pentagons, 5 times 12 is 60. Every corner, you put an atom there, it could be this. And we were so elated. I mean, it was just... it was only later that people said we were wrong that it started to become a bit worrying. But after several months, Rick and Bob had made some measurements. Rick, Bob, and I, and the kids had made some measurements. And then I had a particularly cathartic moment when I realized that we must be right and I wouldn't have to commit suicide. That was really quite an important day, that we would... if we would one day be proven right. And remember, this was a time of cold fusion cold fusion was there.
So coming out there with a thing that looks like a soccer
ball
is
60 carbon. Yeah, and six papers came out after
right.
that. People in the field saying we were wrong. I knew they were wrong because I read the papers very carefully, but other people didn't read them carefully and hadn't done the experiment. But anyway, I expressed it one day because I was going... I only went to Rice for 8 days, but I extended to basically 10 days. And I remember saying that, I remember being on the plane, and my thought was, this plane would fly without engines. You know, I could hold it up, I was so elated, so on such a high. And then gradually you think, well, it's a conjecture. We haven't got the proof. And it took 5 years to prove it. And then we knew, we knew if it was right, it was important. When it was proven correct, we knew it was even more important. And also, I think we were aware that it was probably in there for the big award for science. And I must make sure you realize that in 1984, before that, I was a happy scientist. I was successful. I was a professor. I was successful in all measurements I could have myself. I would have died happy. But when this discovery was made, you thought, well, you know, this might win the big one. And that's the sort of prize it is for me, that I was a lucky person. I suggested an experiment which came up with this incredibly serendipitous discovery. The molecule, we didn't discover it in space. It was discovered in the lab. It was discovered in a situation where we were trying to simulate the conditions in a star. I mean, it hasn't been discovered in space. I'm sure it's there, but that's the situation.
So did you have any thought about geodesic domes before that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, both Rick and I had been to Expo in 1967. I'd been at National Research.
Montreal?
Yeah. I'd been at National Research Council 1964 to 66. And then I wanted to, I just still wasn't going to be a scientist. I mean, I went to Canada just to, Margaret and I went to Canada because I didn't want to live in another country. That was exciting, and a postdoc offered to me. Then I thought I'd like to live in the States, so I wrote to Bell Telephone. I said I'd like to do a little experiment, and I had Johann Pau. Some people were interested in me, so we went for a year, and then I was offered a job back in Sussex, and I went back. But during that 1966 to 67, we went back to Montreal, Marg, Stephen, our son, and we visited, and we went to Expo. And we have photographs and film of the geodesic dome. And because of my interest in graphics, I also got a magazine called Graphis, which is like the major journal of graphic design. It comes out of Switzerland. And they had a whole article on Expo. And the big picture, which was always in my mind, was this picture of the geodesic dome. So when we were conjecturing what it was, I said, well, you know, maybe Buckminster Fuller had got some explanation, because my memory were all these hexagons, which is what graphite is a lot of hexagons. And we got the book, and that image was also in Rick's mind, because he had also visited. And as it turned out, that was a lead to it. And that's why when we were writing the paper, Rick said, we got to call it something. I suggested we call it Buckminster Fullerene. So I said, I remember exactly what it was. C60 :, Buckminster Fullerene. And the ene ending is perfect in the sense that it's got double bonds like benzene mm-hmm. is. And Rick had written it down before he realized it was a long name. And but it was too late. It was down there. And that's how it was named. And then I came back a few weeks later, it was called Buckyball. I thought, well, you know, it's a more majestic name than Buckyball, but kids love it, and that's fine.
Okay, so it says in some of the things I've read about you that you claim to have four, just switching fields slightly here, you have claimed to have four religions.
Yes.
Humanism, atheism, Amnesty Internationalism, and humorism.
Yes.
Would you like to talk about any one of those?
Well, we have discussed atheism here, and I think some very important points have been made. But the trouble with people who look at atheism, they think that's all they are. And I think atheists, it's a very important part of them. And the people would say they're religious. The religion is is an important part of them. But there are all these other things as well. And I think I wanted to say that I'm not just this, I don't believe, okay. There are all these other things as well that are very important to me. And for me, Amnesty International is the one that our family supports first and foremost, because I think we should try to stamp out the inhumanity of human beings to each other. I think Amnesty International is the preeminent organization for all the other things that... The one thing that I can't stand is... things like torture. I mean, some friends of mine say, how can you go to the USA because of, you know, the things are going, gone out of my name and my mind, Guantanamo Bay. And it bothers me because we love America. We've got fantastic friends. I'm surrounded by people who are very much like me, and yet that goes on. That bothers me. And I can't I don't think we can stand it. So that's the first thing. I think that is the first charity, first and foremost charity that we support.
Now, let me just interrupt there for a second, because how old are you, your parents?
No, my parents were 40 when I was born.
Right.
So they died a long time ago.
Right. You still, but how long were you around with them alive?
Oh, my father lived to 77, so I was born when he was 40. So he never saw
me. No religion. I'm just looking at this atheism. There was no religion in the household.
Oh, yes. I've been bar mitzvah, yeah. I've done the whole thing, sung for an hour and all this stuff. But I don't remember ever feeling it was... I don't remember. I just do feel nothing about it. It's very strange. I used to go to what was Jewish Sunday cheder or something like this, and there was this rabbi I didn't really like at all. And I would read this Hebrew, and I didn't know what it, I couldn't understand this.
So you
stuff.
Went to Hebrew school, and the other kids were going to Sunday school.
They might have gone to Sunday school, but I didn't. I never. There was no anti-Semitism or anything. Nothing. I don't feel. Essentially none. I don't remember it. My friends, I don't think they went to Sunday school much. I went to this because my dad made me do this, and it was a very small Jewish community, so they were desperate to have about one bar mitzvah a year. So, you know, I had to do it. That was my turn, so I did it just because they needed to keep some sort of thing going. But I don't remember believing or accepting any part of it at any time. It was a chore. And, you know, this chosen people, I remember all that. I said, I can't accept that. I mean, how could I be chosen when I'm sitting in this thing for 3 hours listening to stuff I don't understand, and they're singing away, and my mates are down at the Casablanca coffee bar having cappuccino. I mean, why did he choose me not to go down where they're having a great time? So you know, this didn't make sense to me. And so, I'm from Bolton, you know. We're very basic sort of people. So I felt very much at one with my friends. And I had good friends. And they were just like me. And the only thing odd was my mother and father, especially my mother, was very gregarious. And if you've ever had... It's like Woody Allen with his... You know, I don't know, New York Stories. There's this incredible personality who somehow didn't dominate my life, but was always there. And very different from the mums of, you know, Keith Entwistle or whatever. You know, they're very different from that. So I had a very unusual upbringing within that one, but a very easy one. My dad didn't go to the synagogue very much, but he wanted me to go, so I had to go every Saturday for quite a long time, and at some point I just stopped. I said, this wasn't for me. And he accepted that, but he still felt something that we've always touched on, that the kids should be brought up in some religion because of this ethical issue. And I think both Mark and I decided that wasn't right. We could do that without any of that claptrap.
Okay. So a couple of things here about... If you hadn't been a scientist, what...
I'd definitely be in graphic art in some ways. And that's the field area that I really feel comfortable at. I mean, I do logos. I've been doing logos for all my life almost. And that's something I'm... Somehow is interesting in the sense that... It's almost like a science. You've got all these parameters. You've got letterings and patterns and fitting them into some solving a problem and stuff like this. And it's the area that I feel most comfortable about. I find science very, very hard. I've got all these fantastically clever friends of mine, and I felt at one point that I've had to be as clever as some of these guys, like a guy called Takeshi Oko, Japanese, who's now in Chicago, or Jim Watson, not the Jim Watson here, but the cleverest guy I know is a Jim Watson in Ottawa, fantastically, you know, Scotsman. I said, I've got to be as clever as this to do science. I've got to do something else. So I thought, I'll give it 5 years. I was offered a job in Sussex back in England, so I went back from Bell Labs after 1 year to Sussex, and they gave me a tenure appointment within 6 months. I said, I'll give myself 5 years, and then I'm getting out, go to night school, back to night school, go into graphics and do this. But I started to motor around 5 years, and so I said, I'll give it another 5 years, and here I am. And in 19, 85, I said, right, this is it. And then this blasted molecule turned up and screwed all my plans up.
We actually, because there's a meeting going on in town, we're going to have to actually wrap this up.
Sure.
But let me just ask you one final thing, which would be the importance of communication of science, obviously crucial with you. Do you want to say something?
Yes, I, to some extent, fell into that because I started to make programs for television, and the Vega logo, which I designed the logo for my graphics studio, that I was going to call Vega Graphics, in about... 12 years ago, I started to make television programs for the BBC. There was an open access slot. And I wanted also a recording of my presentation at the Royal Institution. And so that came on about the same time as a fantastic communicator, science communicator, Bill Klemperer from Harvard, was in the UK. So we recorded that. And my colleague, who was a BBC producer, said we should set up a foundation to do that. And as soon as we'd set it up, he had to leave. So I left with this this foundation, and I managed to get some money to get going and get it started. And we've made 110 programs. Over half have been shown on the BBC. But then as the dynamics of communication changed, the internet became much more important. I really think that is an incredibly important one in the way that it's enabling young people to be creative. And so the next step was to see how can we use the internet. And so I set up another one called Global Educational Outreach, where I think we've got a way which is auto-catalytic, but it's built a studio so young people can come in and do what they want. And that's a democratization, which is what Dan was talking about, of education or communication, but it's democratization of production. And that's what YouTube and Wikipedia have done. And what we're doing at Florida is a democratization of the two together to help teachers teach better. So we're producing a cache of downloadable scientific teaching material. And the iconic image I have is the teacher of biology who next term has to teach physics, has got no physics training, but they're left in the lurch because the physics teacher has gone and got a job. So instead of throwing our hands up in the air and saying, well, we haven't got any science teachers and try and do something about that, let's work with the teachers we've got. They're good teachers, but they need help. We can send them the best teaching material now. They can download it. They can have the best teacher showing them how to present it. The Richard Feynmans, who were fantastic, fantastic communicators, communicating their thing. We could today have Feynman teaching a class, okay, and his material. And all the teacher has to do is watch this, learn it, and they could emulate it. And that's how teaching gets around. That is now feasible. That's what we're doing from FSU. I'm twisting the arms of some of my colleagues in Cambridge in the UK to do the same. We're going to do that in Sheffield, my alma mater, and also in Japan, in South Africa, and other places. And that's what I'm trying to load the bases with, these nodes that are going to actually cover, I think, all possibilities. And that's my final plan. And then I'm going to get my graphic studio set up. I mean,
well,
I'm going to, by 70, Hokusai apparently started at 70, and he did a fantastic job. So if he can do it, I can do it.
Well, we'll come back next time and look at your graphic studio then. Harry Croteau, thanks
so much. Okay, thanks a lot.